Welcome to the Cold Steel Podcast, hosted by Amir Farouk and myself, Chad Ball. We consider it an absolute privilege to bring you guests from around the world who are truly experts in their craft. Our mission is to offer you a combination of not only masterclasses on clinical surgery topics, but also insights into achieving personal growth, productivity, and fulfillment as both a surgeon and perhaps more importantly, as a human.
This week we had a masterclass on common bile duct injuries by Dr. Francis Sutherland. Dr. Sutherland is a hepatobiliary surgeon at the University of Calgary. Dr. Sutherland talks about not just how CBD injuries happen, but why they happen and the cognitive biases that lead up to them. Please check out the show notes for videos and papers that supplement our discussion.
I'm born in Edmonton. I don't like to tell people that, but we moved to Calgary in 1960. Dad was an ophthalmologist. I grew up here largely going to the mountains to go skiing and did my med school here and then my surgical training here and did a two-year transplant fellowship, kidney and liver, in London, Ontario with a fellow named Bill Wall and of course Dave Grant, and really got my grounding in liver and bile duct surgery there, and came back to Calgary in 1990 and started in with general surgery and a small amount of hepatobiliary, but mostly transplant. I ran the kidney transplant program here for about 8 years until I kind of burned out, and then went back to do a sabbatical in France. So we flew the whole family over to Rennes. It's a small place in Brittany, and we did a wonderful sabbatical with a fellow named Bernard Lunois, who was a pioneer hepatobiliary surgeon. And it was a marvelous year and really got me going on HPB surgery, which I came back and really for the past 20 years have been doing HPB both at the Peter Lougheed and here in Foothills. Well, that's the nutshell.
You really have a perspective on the way that surgery has evolved, both locally in Calgary, obviously, but also more generally. And I think one of the neat, amazing things about what you just described is you going to do a sabbatical in France. So I'm curious what that experience was like after having done, obviously, a lot of surgery for those few years, doing transplant surgery and then deliberately going and doing a sabbatical in France, and what that experience was like. And the second thing, just to add on to that, is that I think as part of that experience, you actually ended up writing a review that's in JAMA that talks about the life of Cunard, who the liver segment system is named after. Could you talk about both those things?
I highly recommend sabbaticals for surgeons, and I know it's a very difficult thing to do because to step away from your practice and your referral base is very hard. But I had an opportunity when I stopped transplant to retool, and I got what's called a professor associate position in France. And the French government puts these out every year, and they basically pay people outside of France to come and learn how to do things properly. And the French have a long history of liver surgery going back to Lortin Jacob and the first hepatectomy, and of course Claude Queneau, and then a whole string of liver surgeons, including Bernard Lunois. So it was a wonderful opportunity to take our young children and then try to learn French and try to immerse ourselves in the culture. Bernard and I would operate every day, just him and I. One case, we'd stop for lunch, and it was quite an experience. I have to recommend it to anybody. In terms of Claude Queneau, I spent a lot of my time studying anatomy, and for some reason, liver anatomy has really fascinated me. And this was an opportunity for me to sit down and read all the books. And one day, I was talking to Bernard and just saying how much I've been reading Claude Queneau, and he had a copy of his original book, Le Foie, and I asked him about him. He said, oh, he's in Paris, he's still alive, and and he said he would introduce me. And so I had a friend in Wren who I'd met from Ottawa, and she was a historian of all things. And she and I got on the train and went to Paris and interviewed Claude Queneau in his apartment in Paris, and spent, you know, 3 or 4 hours with him talking about his work on liver anatomy and how he did all his casts and his life in surgery and all the innovations that he'd done. So, and of course it was all in French, and she spoke perfect French, and we translated it, and eventually resulted in an article, Claude Queneau, and is really his biography. So it was a lifetime experience for sure.
Yeah, I'd highly recommend any of our listeners to read that paper. It's really fascinating read and really enjoyable. As I sort of alluded to in my previous comment, you obviously have been able to see the evolution of the way surgery has gone, particularly with regards to HPB. You've all had your fingers in so many different aspects of surgery, from transplant to HPB, and then obviously, you know, you've done the full gamut of general surgery across the board here in Calgary. What do you think are like the big things that have changed in your mind? You know, obviously the technological advances, but I'm thinking more along the lines of the way that we work and the way that we practice. What are the big things that sort of have shifted over the course of your career that you perhaps weren't even expecting?
Yeah. Well, I mean, who can really predict what's going to happen in the future? And gosh, you know, you have to really think hard to go back 30 years to how it was. And when I started my training, family doctors were still doing inguinal hernia repairs at the Foothills Hospital. And we look at how surgery has changed. And really, one of the areas that it's probably changed the most is just in terms of subspecialization and getting everybody in to do a little more narrower practice, and the resulting massive improvements in the quality of surgical care that's been delivered, I think, is probably the biggest change. We tend to be more narrow, and we tend to be better at what we do now. And I think it's been a great benefit to our patients. Not that general surgeons aren't still important, but you know, I think the idea of the generalist being able to do it all is just it doesn't work anymore. And the other thing that's big changed is that the fact that we treat almost every patient. There's not anybody where we say, oh, there's nothing you can do for you. We really have extended the indications for surgery, and I think can help a lot more people.
That's an interesting perspective. You know, being able to tell someone that you can't treat them, and you're right, is not something that we do often, even in HPB, which is interesting. I was hoping that we would go deep on bile duct injuries and some of the concepts that you've really pioneered that surround it. You know, for me, and I don't just say this because you're my mentor and my partner, but I think of the titans of modern bile duct injury work. I think of Michelle Mercado in Mexico. I think of Keith Lillimo in the US and Steve Strasburg. And I put you, you know, as the fourth member of that selective group. You've really thought about these deeply and profoundly for a very long period of time. I'm curious to start out with then, what prompted you to think about them in such a deep way, even more than most HPB surgeons? Why has it been such an interest for you for so long?
Well, thanks, Chad. Yeah, I think when I came back from France in 1999 and started in really hard at my HPB surgery practice, I just started to see a lot of these injuries and really got the sense of how devastating the injury is to the patients, but not just the patients, to the surgeons themselves. I mean, it is an emotionally draining experience. A loss of confidence in the consequences can have a profound effect on someone's career. So there's lots of reasons to try to avoid these injuries. And so it was after fixing and dealing with you know, the fallout from a lot of these injuries that I really started to get an interest and started to read. Now, clearly, I went through the the period of introduction of laparoscopic cholecystectomy and saw the rates go massively up, and they and then stay up. Really, they've stayed up through my whole career. And then, you know, starting to read and then starting to see people trying to get a handle on it. You know, Steve Strasburg's Critical View of Safety in 1995. But really, the landmark papers that got me going were, you know, Lawrence Way's paper on the illusion of bile duct injuries and the fact that it's really not a technical error. It's an error in perception. And it's this whole idea of difficulty in perception that that really struck me as particularly interesting. And then after that, I, you know, standing on the shoulder of giants, an Australian surgeon named Thomas Hugh has written a lot about the navigation error that bile duct injuries are on top of the illusion. And he's a guy that went over and did a full sabbatical, a full master's on bile duct injuries, and then has written extensively on landmarking and the illusion and a lot of the things that I've just extended the observations. And so a lot of what I'm talking about isn't original, but it is something that I've taken up from these other, you know, giants in the field.
Well, you're right, but you're also, you know, overly humble. I assure you of that. When I see you talk about this, especially recently, you sort of divide your grand rounds or your lectures into two dominant areas. The first is you seem to talk about how these injuries happen, and the second is avoiding them, which I think makes a lot of sense. So I was wondering if you could start us off then with how they happen, what's going on in that surgeon's mind, and failures of navigation and correction in particular.
Yeah, I've tried to compartmentalize it in terms of why it happens, and really compartmentalize it into the three things. And in terms of, you know, what is our, how do we think, you know? And one of the things that really got me going on this was really reading Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, and then getting interested in cognitive psychology. And that really got me going in terms of thinking about trying to apply that to surgery and how we think when we operate and how we've inherited a lot of our basic thought processes from our ancestors and how did Homo sapiens really function on the African savannah and how the thinking, how the fact that they're, you know, we've been mostly all our evolution has been as big game hunters and how that process goes and how the fact that we have to be thinking very quickly. We have to be able to process, deal with ambiguity, deal with uncertainty, and make an indefinite percept a definite and move forward. And that you see that in the way surgeons operate. We think very quickly. We use heuristics and shortcuts, and we move very quickly forward. And that whole concept really gets consolidated in the idea that we operate with cognitive maps, and we place the map or the construct onto the anatomy that we find, and then this allows us to move very quickly forward without making a lot of assumptions and without dissecting everything carefully. We can basically put our map on the basis of a few landmarks and then do the dissection. So cognitive maps are really one of the things that I really started to think about a lot. And there's a professor here at the University of Calgary named Giuseppe Iaria, who I've talked to and collaborated with a little bit. And he is doing all kinds of original research on cognitive maps in our large scale environment and how we use cognitive maps to navigate. And that concept of large scale environment cognitive maps, we basically take and look at the surgeon's small scale environment and how we use cognitive maps to navigate through our operative field based on on landmarks and knowledge that we've stored over many, many years of developing our skills. And when you think about it carefully, it all our training and all the work we do in terms of understanding surgery is really just building up a library of cognitive maps. And they're schematized, and we hold them in our mind, and we bring them forward whenever the situation arises and use them in our dissections. And so if you understand the idea of cognitive maps and how surgeons think, then you can apply that to say, well, what happens when it goes wrong? And that is really a little bit about why we fail to navigate. I used to call it a failure of perception, but now I call it a failure of navigation based on a lot of Thomas Hughes' work. And so the concept here is that a surgeon navigates his field, and at the starting point of the operation, there's a critical moment where he uses the anatomy present and places his or her cognitive map on the area to operate. That's the concept. And so if you get that starting point wrong in your dissection, then everything else that goes after that can be a disaster. And for cognitive maps and for the subhepatic space, the mistake would be that, say, there's some inflammation and there's no proper hepatobiliary triangle, your attention is diverted over to the central porta habitus, you place your cognitive map by mistake in that area, and then start your dissection. And then what results is the division of the common hepatic duct as if it's the cystic duct, and then working your way up, making a critical view of safety, working your way up the left side of the bile duct like it is the underside of the gallbladder, and then using cautery to go right through the common hepatic duct. Or if you're really disoriented, go right through the hilar plate and do a hilar plate injury, which is of course, even more of a disaster. Now, the really sinister thing about this is that once you've divided through the bile duct, it places you back in the right plane. You take out the gallbladder, and half of these cases, the surgeons don't even recognize that what they've done is take out a chunk of gallbladder and left the bile duct, hepatic duct open. So it's a really a difficult thing to understand, but I think that a cognitive map gives us a little bit of an idea how the navigation error actually happens. The second thing that we've looked at, and we did this together, is to look at an illusion. And it was really Lawrence Way that really brought that forward, that what's happening to the surgeons is an optical illusion. And that's a situation where even quickly our automatic thinking system misinterprets the anatomy present. And then even with a lot of thought and careful analysis, you still get it wrong. So it's a very dangerous situation for a surgeon. And it was Hugh that really showed a diagram where the bile duct kinks, and this is how the illusion happens. And this is what brings the surgeon into the central porta habitus triangle, looking at that kink with the pulling of the Hartmann's pouch, the kinking of the common hepatic and the common bile duct. So we did a little study where we looked and see, does this really happen? Does the bile duct really kink? And so we took, you know, over 100 pictures and then analyzed it. And we found out that, yeah, the bile duct really can kink. And the angle that it produces can overlap with the angles of the hepatobiliary triangle. So we thought that really shows that indeed an illusion may be part of this injury. So that's our failure of navigation. And then the third part of it, the third part of this triad is a failure of correction. And this really deals with why, when we start making an error, do we not find it, correct it, and then get back into the right area. And this deals with cognitive biases, which are systematic errors that we all make. You know, it's sort of jumping to conclusions and not fixing them. And some of them that are particular, there's hundreds of them, but some of them that are particular to surgeons are primacy, so that what we see first, it's difficult to get off that. Availability bias, and that's it's hard to think of another avenue to operate in. Action bias. I mean, we all want to go forward. We want to go forward quickly. So there's a bias to keep things moving. Confirmation bias, probably the granddaddy, is that once we decide what we're going to do and what the things is, everything else we see confirms our original opinion. And lastly, overconfidence, and surgeons suffer from this, and it can get as bad as hubris. So those can all predispose to errors. And those are all, you know, inherited things that we do. So those are the three areas that we worked on. The cognitive maps are really the central part of and sort of what we've taken beyond the simple failure of perception.
I always get so excited when someone talks about Daniel Kahneman. I just think his work has impacted so many different areas of the way we think, the way we understand, the way that we think. Just this week, I was reading a paper of his that where he looked at pain that people had after having colonoscopy, and just like a simple thing that, or if they left the scope in at the end of the case without moving it, so that the very end of the case was less painful, patients had less, had a better overall experience. Like, there's just so many things that Kahneman has had an impact on.
I read his book over and over, and every time I read it, I learn something new. You know, and just the whole concept of how we learn things and how a resident operates gets better at operating versus somebody who's experienced. It's fascinating.
Yeah, he actually has a new book that's coming out recently as well, which is, I think, is also going to be equally as fascinating. I wanted to ask you, though, so there's two parts. One is, I remember as a resident, you had actually done some studies and looked at actually how people use landmarking. And I remember being part of this study where you actually had us kind of this virtual map when you were kind of going through this city, and you ask participants to kind of recreate their mental map. I'm curious what that study showed. And then the second question I have for you is, why was there an increase? Like, what's different about laparoscopic surgery that this optical illusion happens, where you think that you're dissecting on the cystic duct, but you're actually dissecting on the common bile duct?
Really, now we're getting into the whole idea of how do we avoid bile duct injuries, and that's where the landmarking study. And I like to say that this is my landmark study. It's the only way I'll ever say it. And Chad was obviously involved with this significantly. So, I mean, Thomas Hugh, again, one of my heroes, he published a paper it's got to be in the 90s, looking at the sulcus of Rouvier as a landmark for navigating the cholecystectomy. And so that really got me thinking that perhaps there are other landmarks there that will help us set our cognitive map, set our navigation, so that we can navigate clearly with the right starting point. And so we did a little study where we basically took pictures and looked at the subhepatic space in about 130 consecutive laparoscopic cholecystectomies. And then we analyzed and cataloged the landmarks below the liver that could be used to orient for cholecystectomy. And, you know, there's three things about a landmark you have to make it useful. I mean, the first thing is it has to be there in a large number of the cases. The second is it has to be, you know, easy to identify and find. And lastly, it has to give you good relational information about the critical structures that you're either trying to find or avoid. So We were looking for landmarks that would meet those criteria. And after the review of 130 of these cases, we came up with five landmarks and that are consistently there a lot and give good information on where you are in space, given that spatial disorientation is the ultimate mistake. And Chad came up with the mnemonic Be Safe. So the five landmarks are, first of all, the bile duct, which is probably the best landmark. If you're trying to avoid the bile duct and you can identify the bile duct, well, that really is critical. And that's what a lot of our maneuvers are. That's what the cholangiograms for and ultrasound and all the other things that they've used to prevent injury. So we found actually that, you know, in almost 80% of the cases, if you push the duodenum down or you push the liver up, that you can see a portion of the bile duct and identify where it is. I think that's a useful observation in and of itself. The second landmark was the sulcus of Rouvier, again, from Hughes' work. It's an excellent landmark because it is always at or below the hepatobiliary triangle. So if you're operating below the sulcus of Rouvier, you're too low. The third one was the hepatic artery, not really recognized before, but if you look carefully, you can almost always see the pulsation of the left hepatic artery, and it tells you where the left side of the porta hepatis is. The third landmark is the umbilical fissure. Again, if you're below the umbilical fissure, you're way too far to the patient's left. And the last landmark is E for enteric, and that merely means the duodenum. If you're close to the duodenum, you're too low. So, I mean, the navigation error is, to understand it, it's when you're operating in the porta hepatis, you're too far to the patient's left and you're too low. So if you see that you use these landmarks and you see that you're in that space, or you're under the umbilical fossa, or you're under the sulcus of Rouvier, or you're on the left side of the bile duct, you know three-dimensionally that you are in the wrong space, and the flag should go up and you have to reorient. We're all talking about orienting during laparoscopic cholecystectomy. The laparoscope question. Well, it is a very interesting question, and it is interesting that in the early 90s, when bile duct injuries went crazy, that's when the laparoscope was introduced. And there's several things that happen in a laparoscope that you don't get when you're open. When you're open, you really do look and understand the subhepatic space and the porta hepatis, the stomach, the markings on the liver. And when you're doing the laparoscope or using a laparoscope, your view becomes very much diminished, very much narrowed, and you tend to focus and get close and you lose all of those landmarks. So it's very much easier to become disoriented and misplace your map. And the other thing that I think is really important is that, you know, the old time general surgeons that would do, you know, common duct explorations, and they would do maybe a few Whipples and some gastrectomies. I mean, they really understood the porta hepatis, and of course open cholecystectomies. And the students, the kids that are coming out today, they don't have that experience. So their cognitive map is very diminished. They don't have a full understanding anymore of this anatomy. And really, the Be Safe landmarks to orient during laparoscopic cholecystectomy are a way for our young surgeons to expand their cognitive map so they can orient more correctly.
Recently listened to a podcast, and I'll link to it here in the show notes, where there was a great discussion among a bunch of different surgeons, and they were actually talking about fenestrating and subtotal gallbladders. And one of there's sort of one camp that said, well, why would you do this subtotal or a fenestrating when you could open and use your hand and really try to get the gallbladder out that way? And the other group was saying, well, you know, I don't, you know, you can get into all sorts of trouble doing that as well. it's slightly off our topic of cognitive illusions, but I'm curious, you know, with this divide in training regimes and training experience, how you sort of view the move of opening when you're struggling to actually find the critical view.
Well, I think it really talks a lot about how things have changed for surgeons, and really I think it's really important for surgeons to know what they're capable of. I think it is one fundamental thing that, you know, really deals with patient safety. And it is unfortunate that many young surgeons really don't feel they have the capability to do an open cholecystectomy. And it's hard to train to do an open cholecystectomy because you might only see them when you're doing your hepatobiliary rotation, and there might only be a few, and they're done with normal gallbladders too. So getting that experience of an open cholecystectomy with an inflamed gallbladder is extremely difficult. Now, the idea of a subtotal, I do them all the time, and I think it's the way to go. And I do them open and I do them laparoscopic. And my default, because I'm comfortable, is to go open. I think the idea that you always have to remove the gallbladder is just wrong. No gallbladder absolutely has to be removed, and we can treat these things with tubes, and the radiologist can fish the stones out and crush them. So we shouldn't ever feel pressured to take out a gallbladder. The other thing is that sometimes the gallbladder wall doesn't even exist. So if you're trying to take out a gallbladder where it doesn't exist, you're really going to hurt something. And the gallbladder might be fused to the common bile duct. It can be fused or non-existent to the duodenum or liver. And more I find myself taking out as much of the gallbladder as I'm comfortable with. I think the key is probably taking out all the stones and then either closing the stump or just draining it. And it's the safest thing to do. Really you can keep yourself out of trouble. It's when you try to do too much that you really can make things go badly.
I think that's beautifully said, obviously. And I would point our readers to Strasburg's classification of subtotal cholecystectomies in Journal American College, I think about 2016 mm-hmm. or so. You know, he talks about fenestrating cholecystectomy versus reconstituting cholecystectomy under the umbrella of partial cholecystectomy. And I think, you know, the classification's a little bit arbitrary, but it is well defined as, you know, the fenestrating side of things doesn't really occlude the gallbladder, whereas your reconstitution version of it will leave a remnant gallbladder. You know, one of the things I think that we all see as HPB surgeons in terms of referrals, is more and more remnant cholecystitis and biliary colic is related to that. And certainly I think your comment about removing the stones is probably critical, right?
Yeah, you know, I've never had to go back and take out a stump when the surgeon's taken out the stones, or I've taken out the stones. And it's only when that's not done that you have, you know, they can get recurrent. And it's not a very fun operation to go back.
Oh, no, it's true.
I mean, I always go laparoscopic, but then some of them go open. So
for sure. I wanted to sneak back. You use the sentence, but we certainly haven't explored it. And that's intraoperative cholangiography. And I think we all know that these large multinational population-based studies all show that routine intraoperative cholangiography doesn't seem to be beneficial, or in particular lower your bile duct injury rate overall. But I'm curious, you know, I think as a group, we certainly don't do very many. Why do you think that is? And do you think there is a role for someone who's not an HPB surgeon and less comfortable with biliary anatomy maybe to do that procedure or not?
Not. I always thought it was a good skill to be able to do a cholangiogram, and with my thoughts of this being a navigation error, I'm just not sure that cutting a hole in a duct and putting a tube in and doing an X-ray that, you know, you're probably not going to be able to interpret properly is really the proper avenue for, you know, finding out where you are when you're disoriented. I think really, you know, the backing up and the subtotal cholecystectomy, the limited subtotal cholecystectomy is probably a better strategy. Having said that, I mean, identifying the bile duct is one of our landmarks. And I think apart from cholangiography, ultrasound or Endosine and Green or some of the other technologies for identifying that landmark, I'd have no problem with those whatsoever. But I just don't think that, you know, that cutting the bile duct open and doing a cholangiogram is a good idea.
Yeah, obviously I'm biased based on your education and investment in me, but I would certainly agree. You know, it is interesting as the technologies change, you're right. And Indocyanine and Green is certainly pushed hard by industry, but I'm not sure it changes the equation at all, really.
No, I think we have to rely on our operative technique and maybe not little less on technology. But I think one of the things I wanted to say that I really haven't mentioned so far is that this idea of the B-safe landmarks, I think, is something that we can add on to all the other aspects. These are not mutually exclusive. Looking for B-safe landmarks and the, you know, the Bill Walls six-clip rule or the critical view of safety are all something that we can do all of these things. None of them have primacy as far as I'm concerned. And one of the things that when we talk about B-safe landmarks, we're really talking about taking a timeout. And, you know, there's more written about taking a timeout now. And obviously it's a situation where you can either slow down, like Carol Ann Moulton, slow down and in a difficult critical situation. And it can go right through to stopping, right through to stopping and getting another pair of eyes on the difficult situation. So our idea really is to take a timeout, a B-safe or bile duct timeout at the beginning of the procedure and use the landmarks. It takes seconds, back the camera out, look at all the landmarks, set your map, and then go forward. And then maybe even take another timeout before you start clipping any critical structures. And timeouts are important because they're a strategy to de-bias our thinking. Take us from Kahneman's system one, automatic thinking, to the more deep, figure it out type system two thinking. And you know, that's what the safe surgery checklist is. And surgeons should be using, you know, timeouts all the time, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about the fact that the critical view of safety as a sort of a schema and a way of trying to avoid this problem has been there now for, I think, almost 40 years, if I'm not mistaken, at least 30 years.
1995.
Yeah, so it's been out for a long time. And
yeah,
so,
for sure.
You know, we still are seeing relatively stable rates of bile duct injuries. I think not as quite as high, if I remember correctly, not quite as high as when they first came out, no. But certainly stable rates. And so I'm curious, you know, you talked about this idea of timeouts, but do you ever think that getting to a zero bile duct injury rate or a zero bile duct injury event type of thing, if that's achievable and what we would need to be able to do to get there?
Well, no, I don't. I think there are certain limits to human endeavors, technical situations that we can only get to be so good. And some people will argue that maybe we've reached that limit with bile duct injury rates at the, you know, 0.3 and 0.4%. And I'm not so sure we've arrived at the best we can do. I think we can do better. So that's why, hence the idea of a new strategy. You know, these are very changing surgeon, changing human behavior is extremely difficult and happens very slowly. You should ask yourself, well, why does the critical view of safety not want work? And I think there's a conceptual difference. The critical view of safety tells you where you should be. The Be Safe Landmarks perhaps tells you more where you shouldn't be. So they're kind of almost fundamentally different. It's the critical view of safety is not really a navigation strategy, and sometimes the habitability triangle just it doesn't exist. And there's been a few papers that have shown surgeons can be convinced that they're making a critical view of safety when they're in fact making it in the porta habitus triangle. It is a good strategy, but it's not the be all and end all. I hope Steve's not listening.
Yeah, exactly. We'll sort of end this segment or end the podcast. And again, thank you for your time with a question about training I have for you. You know, as you've talked about, you've been in this game very deep for well over 3 decades. And I'm curious, when it comes to safe cholecystectomy, avoiding bile duct injuries and understanding biliary anatomy, in the modern training era, and you teach residents and fellows every single day, what advice would you give those trainees in terms of, you know, recruiting and obtaining that knowledge and that expertise technically to the best that they can, again, with the current training paradigm in mind?
Yeah, I think Kahneman really dealt with this in his book a bit. I think that surgeons have a wonderful opportunity in training in that what we do, we receive immediate feedback. We receive feedback from our operative field and we receive feedback from our mentors. And when you're doing something and someone is correcting you and you see the results right away, it's a really powerful learning situation. I think that from a cognitive psychology point of view, from a cognitive map point of view, really the idea is to explore your environment and spend as much time as you can exploring your environment and getting feedback. And so, you know, you see residents start with basically no cognitive map whatsoever. And the only way to develop that cognitive map is to be there and to be there over and over and over again. So, you know, you might say, well, I've already seen a cholecystectomy. No, have you seen 100? Have you seen 500 cholecystectomies? Because that's how long it takes to really get good at it. And we're not just the basic anatomy, all the different variations of anatomy and all the different tissues and how the different tissues basically behave and separate or don't separate. And it's very complicated. And the only way you can be there is to get there, work hard at it, and develop your repertoire of cognitive maps that you can use throughout your whole life. And when you're young, you can develop cognitive maps. There's a lot of evidence now that when you get to be old, and Chad, old means more than 46, you lose the ability to create new cognitive maps and to use your maps effectively. So that there's something to think about.
Well, that's perfect, because I'm older than 46. I'm good. I'm bugging you. The last question we want to ask, and we try and ask everyone, as you know, having listened to some of these podcasts, is if you were to go back and talk to a young Francis Sutherland, a keen-eyed intern or early junior resident, what sort of advice would you like to give yourself back in the day?
Yeah, I think I'd probably say to myself, don't be so hard on yourself. Let the mistakes float over you a little more easily than beating yourself up. I think sometimes we set a bar for ourselves that it is too high, and we suffer for it. I would say concentrate more on some specific areas where you can make a difference, and don't try to be sort of all inclusive. And you know, get outside and ride your bike more often, I think.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. We love to hear your thoughts, comments, and feedback, so send us an email at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or tweet at us @CanJSurge. Thanks again.